Let's get kinky. You're listening to the Funny Dom Podcast.
Good evening, folks, and welcome to the show. This week, I'm going to talk about kink events a little bit more. Recently went to a large kink event with Bunny, and it was a big milestone for us, and many thresholds were crossed for both of us. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Also going to share with you a brief recording from the event that I made, which I think is fun and I think will help make the idea of attending an event like this, if you are interested or curious about them, a little bit less intimidating, as I feel a lot of people might feel that way, and I remember feeling that way about these events. So you have the opportunity to hear bit of a gonzo style, you know, live recording, a field recording from a kink event. And I think that'll be fun. And I'll just talk about our experience and what it was like. So I think that'll be of interest. I hope you enjoy it. We'll also have some listener questions to get to and a continued reading by the fire of Diana Gabaldon's Outlander. So kick back and relax, and if you are listening to this while you're doing some chores, then and get to a nice meditative place with that and enjoy the show.
Hello, sir. So I'm not really here with a question, but I'm here to tell about an experience that I had. So I went with a few of my friends to a lecture about serial killers. I'm just really into true crime, and I had the tickets for the lecture for, I think, over a month. So I was very excited about it, and I went with some friends from the university that have no idea about my lifestyle, about my current dynamic with my dom. They're just a different part of my life. So we went to the lecture, and at the very beginning of the lecture, the professor was talking about how the fantasies of serial killers are much like BDSM. And he was talking about how participating in BDSM starts with innocent and harmless fantasies, and how it can accelerate to, as he was saying, horrible things. And just like that, serial killers start with harmless fantasies and end up killing people for pleasure. And I was just sitting there, just shocked and just so sad and angry. I know that many people do not understand BDSM, but it's okay to not understand us, and I know that some people are judging us, but comparing us as a community to serial killers, that was something that I have never heard before, and I was so deeply hurt by that comment, and I couldn't even do anything about it, because I couldn't just, like, get up and go and explain why I'm so upset, because those friends they don't know that part of my life. So it was just a very difficult experience for me, and to hear that from a professor, an educated man, was just hard for me to hear.
Well, first of all, thank you for sending in that experience and sharing that with me so that I could share it with the audience here. I'm sorry you had to go through that. I'm sure there's some people listening who have had a similar kind of experience. It is so frustrating when anybody that you're in contact with, sometimes whether it's a friend or it could be a family member or even just in media, when you see a completely ignorant or narrow-minded or just plain wrong opinion being touted about kink or BDSM. And it's doubly frustrating if you're in a context or you're in a position where you don't feel comfortable challenging it, and so you just scream inside your own head, because it's almost like a bit of like a quasi gaslighting, where because you can't challenge it, you start taking on, is this the truth? Is this the reality? You know, and then you wait for someone else to challenge it. And if they don't, again, it seems to like validate this ridiculous, narrow-minded opinion. I'm sure when you're in that lecture, if someone had put their hand up or just stood up and said, excuse me, I have experience in this and I feel that this opinion that you're using, this comparison is completely incorrect and is actually just creating shame and a judgmental kind of cultural viewpoint on what is actually a very functional and healthy lifestyle and identity for a lot of people. And I don't know if anyone would have broken out into applause. I would have. If I was in that room and someone said something like that, I would have just stood up and started just slow clapping and applauding. And I would hope other people would. I think that at least you would definitely have people in the room nodding and kind of saying, that's what I think too. That sounds right to me. And because nobody did, it does or can feel like maybe that's true, or what they're saying is believed by others, or now it is believed by others, and everyone was kind of just doesn't know and is listening. And that's so frustrating. Please know that your intuition and your instincts to be horrified by what this lecturer said is absolutely right. Comparing kink or kink exploration to the way serial killers escalate in their methodology, I think is beyond ridiculous and stupid, especially from someone who's supposed to be not only educated but supposed to be educating others. I do not think there are any any studies, any authorities who have found something to back up this, the use of this as a comparison. I don't know where it's coming from. If there is, I'd like to hear about it. I feel like this is purely coming from somebody who is using this crazy weird thing, you know, of kink and BDSM as a comparison for serial killers, purely coming from a kind of just completely ignorant and bigoted point of view. Like, there's no experience there. There's probably actually some projecting of insecurity or just narrow-mindedness by that lecturer. There's some kind of, possibly some kind of repressed sexuality there. Not to like attack or diminish that person, but just why would you have such a backwards opinion on something in this day and age? I don't know. There's going to be something going on there. At the very least, it's just plain ignorance and insensitivity. And they're just not considering that this is actually a lifestyle and identity of a lot of people, probably a lot of people in the room. And what he's doing is comparing it to serial killing. It's gross, it's disgusting, and it's so stupid and fucking wrong. So I'm sorry you had to listen to that. Thank you for sharing it, so that I hope that it helped sharing it, and I hope that it will help hearing it being shared and getting to hear someone else vent about it and know that other people are listening to this right now. And completely, like, we're together. Like, we agree with you on this. That would have been horrible and frustrating. And a couple messages here from listeners of our first episode. This is from Victoria. I absolutely loved listening to this morning during my walk in the park with JT Dogs. so informative. I can't wait for the next episode. Thanks, Victoria. And also, another one here from Panda Puffs Marie. Advice for vetting a dom. I've let myself be fooled by little loopholes plenty of times and I'm getting a bit tired. Look, I'm not sure what the loopholes are or what your vetting process is, but I'd hazard to say that it needs to be upgraded. It certainly can be tiring looking for a partner and getting through a lot of communication and effort and then finding that it isn't going to work. Now, even if it's just a compatibility issue, it's still a lot of energy. And if it's certainly, the finding is that this person is fake or not legitimate in some way, then it does feel like a complete waste of energy, which it, you know, it kind of is. But what you can take away from it is that, perhaps your vetting needs to be, worked on a little bit so that it doesn't feel like you've put so much energy in. I really think that in just an hour or, 10, 20 minutes of if you're chatting to someone, if you don't put in a lot of conversational energy and you just directly get into proper vetting questions, I really don't think these, fake DOMs and exploiters will really get very far. If you get a copy of my vetting guide that's on my Patreon, and then use that. It's basically just 5 steps, and it just really, you just got to be very upfront and just get straight into what their experiences are, what their attitudes are with play and with care and with safe words, and also critically ask them about their other partners. Ask them if you can be put in touch with a current submissive of theirs or a past submissive. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to do that. Like, that might be uncomfortable for you, and they might be uncomfortable putting forward someone to put you in touch with. It's almost mostly about their reaction. So if you suggest speaking with another partner of theirs and they get defensive or they try to minimize the need for that, that's an answer. That's telling you a lot, because a legitimate dom will actually see that as a very, very reasonable request and will try and put you in touch with another partner and will have partners that they can put you in touch with. So really, if they're open to it, then that's also kind of like telling you like a positive thing. If they're negative about that request at all, then that's the red flag. So just try being quite direct. Do not second guess yourself. Do not give in to thinking that asking all these questions quite immediately, quite directly, and expecting good answers is too much. It's not. And if you do that, then you really won't waste very much time, because they won't have the right answers, and you can immediately say, no, thank you, goodbye.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content, and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.
Now, to begin our talk on kink events and attending them, what they're like and how to be less intimidated by them, what to expect, I'm going to play a short recording that I took from the recent Hellfire Resurrection event that was held by the Oz Kink Fest just a couple weeks ago here in Melbourne. I attended with Bunny, and it was her first big, like, full play type event, and it was the biggest event I've been to, and we were both there and ready to cross quite a few thresholds, which we did. So I took a little recording while we were there, and I'd like to start this look at events by playing it for you. And this is us at Hellfire, and you can hear the atmosphere and the many people that were around us. We were sitting on a couch, and you might even be able to hear some impact play that's happening in the background. So here's a little kind of sneak, kind of from the field listen at a genuine play kink event. Hope you enjoy.
Okay, this is Sir TFT Danny sitting on a couch surrounded by many, many kinky folk. There's spanking and all manner of things happening behind us right now. A lot of folks standing around watching, and I have Bunny on my lap right now. Say hello, Bunny.
Hello.
And what have you been up to tonight, Bunny?
I got smacks.
You got smacks?
Daddy gave you smacks,
that's right. And we showed up just on time to be in line for the cloakroom for about half an hour. And we got to drink. And what did we do first? We got cozy, walked around a little bit.
Looked around at the different rooms.
Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different loungy rooms and booth rooms and a big stage. And we just saw some suspension, a big show on the main stage. And what else have we seen? Lots of impact. Lots of people playing.
Cool outfits.
Lots of cool outfits, that's true. And babies, you've got your harness on and your collar.
Daddy got them for me.
That's right. Are you having a good time being led around in a loop by Daddy?
Yes, Daddy.
Yeah? We've had a good time and a few drinks, and it's probably nearly 1 a.m. I think, about that. Might be a little bit later. This thing goes till like 3 or 4. In my experience, it's best to not do the whole epic night. Do a few hours and then give yourself some energy. So we'll probably do that soon. Get home and get cozy and do some more playing. Won't we? Yeah. Yeah, this has been here at the Hellfire Resurrection. It's been a lot of kinky fun. And yeah, it continues. So this has been a little field report from a couch surrounded by about 100 kinky folk with lots of stuff going on right behind us right now. And we're just having a cozy little moment with Bunny on my lap. It's been quite an intense, overwhelming night. We've had lots of fun. So hope everyone enjoys this. So bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And listening back to that, I'm so glad that you can hear all the impact play happening behind us and all the chatter around us. You can really feel the very warm, social, chatty vibe that was there at that event. And although at the end of that recording, I was talking to Bunny about perhaps us heading home soon, I think we actually stuck around for another hour or two because we had quite a bit more play after that. And then we talked a lot about what thresholds we were going to cross, and we had discussed doing some impact play and Daddy giving her some smacks, which we did. And we talked a little bit about other kinds of playing, but I didn't want there to be any objective for that or any pressure. So we kind of left that open to just see how comfortable we both were, because simply going to that big event together was a threshold. But we were quite comfortable, and we actually did quite a bit of play in two of the lounge areas. First, I believe, I got Bunny to sit in my lap, and she did make Daddy very hard, and then I told her it would be great if she got down on her knees at my feet and put her mouth to use And she said, yes, Daddy, and she did. And I was surprised just how, while aware I was of the few dozen or so people around us, I was mostly very focused on the dynamic and on her and her excellent focus on what she was doing, pleasing me, being of good use. It got quite spacey. I'm not even sure how long we did that for. I do remember really enjoying at one point when we wanted to go and have another wander around. I told her to put Daddy away, and I enjoyed watching her push me back into my trousers and zip up my pants. And I took her lead, and we got up and left that area while I was still very hard. I really liked that. And a bit later on in another area, I got her to sit facing forward and bend down and ease herself down onto me and just bounce on top of Daddy for a while. And I know Bunny really likes that position, as do I. I like the amount of control and the amount of relaxation you can still have, and being able to praise her own efforts and also to grab her hips and push her down. There was a funny moment when she was on top and very, very spacey after riding for a little while, and she was laid back on top of me, and somebody approached us, a friend of mine, a dominatrix, came up to say hello. It was a very wholesome hello, like, oh, hello there. And I could tell it was a friend of mine, but I couldn't quite place who it was because the lighting was quite, you know, quite atmosphery and down and vibey, and I couldn't quite see her face well. And I think I was just really spacey and a bit gone. And I just did that social thing of, oh, hello, and just waved while I'm sitting there in this lounge, and Bunny sprawled on top of me, and I'm still deep inside her. And she just gave a wave and then left. And the next day, a day or two later maybe, I was talking to that beautiful friend, and she was showing me photos. She posted photos from the event, and I was like, oh, you were there. She's like, yeah, didn't I say hello to you? And then it clicked, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, yes, that was you. And she said, you were a little busy. I was a bit busy. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I think at one point even I could barely notice. I was just cognizant of Bunny on her knees, sucking and gagging, and then right next to us, another couple had really kind of escalated, and she was riding her partner, and I think they were kind of maybe bouncing off the energy that we had kind of initiated. I'm not sure. One of those kind of things you just realize, oh, that's happening right there. So that was our experience at a big kink play party event. And I hope you enjoyed hearing about it and hearing a little recording live from that event. And if you are thinking of going to that kind of event, I hope that helped make it a little less intimidating. And now it's time for our ongoing story time segment. I'm reading Dinah Gabaldon's Outlander. So we're going to get right back into that now.
Sometime later, cuddled close behind bolted shutters, I lifted my head from his shoulder and said, "Why did you ask me that earlier? About whether I'd had anything to do with any Scots? I mean, you must know I had. There are all sorts of men through these hospitals." He stirred and ran a hand softly down my back. Nothing really. Just when I saw that chap outside, it occurred to me that he might be..." He hesitated, tightening his hold a bit. That he might have been someone you'd nursed, perhaps. Maybe heard you were staying here and came along to see. Something like that." "In that case," I said practically, "why wouldn't he come in and ask to see me?" "Well," Frank's voice was very casual, "maybe he didn't want particularly to run into me." I pushed up onto one elbow, staring at him. We had left one candle burning and I could see him well enough. He had turned his head and was looking oh so casually off towards the chromolithograph of Bonnie Prince Charlie, with which Mrs. Bard had seen fit to decorate our wall. I grabbed his chin and turned his head to face me. He widened his eyes in simulated surprise. "Are you implying," I demanded, "that the man you saw outside was some sort of..." I hesitated, looking for the proper word. "Liaison?" he suggested helpfully. "Romantic interest of mine," I finished. No, certainly not," he said unconvincingly. He took my hands away from his face and tried to kiss me, but now it was my turn for head turning. He settled for pressing me back down to lie beside him. "It's only," he began, "well, you know, Claire, it was 6 years, and we saw each other only 3 times. And only just for the day that last time. It wouldn't be unusual if... I mean, everyone knows doctors and nurses are under tremendous stress during emergencies, and, well, it's just that I'd understand, you know, if anything of a spontaneous nature..." I interrupted this rambling by jerking free and exploding out of bed. "Do you think I've been unfaithful to you?" I demanded. "Do you? Because if so, you can leave this room this instant, leave this house altogether. How dare you imply such a thing?" I was seething, and Frank, sitting up, reached out to try and soothe me. "Don't you touch me," I snapped. "Just tell me, do you think, on the evidence of a strange man happening to glance up at my window, that I've had some flaming affair with one of my patients?" Frank got out of bed, wrapped his arms around me. I stayed stiff as Lot's wife, but he persisted, caressing my hair and rubbing my shoulders in the way he knew I liked. "No, I don't think any such thing," he said firmly. He pulled me closer and I relaxed slightly, though not enough to put my arms around him. After a long time, he murmured into my hair, "No, I know you'd never do such a thing. I only meant to say that even if you ever did, Claire, it would make no difference to me. I love you so. Nothing you ever did could stop my loving you." He took my face between his hands. Only 4 inches taller than I, he could look directly into my eyes without trouble, and said softly, "Forgive me?" His breath, barely scented with the tang of whiskey, was warm on my face, and his lips, full and inviting, were disturbingly close. Another rumble of thunder heralded the sudden breaking of the storm, and a thundering rain smashed down on the slates of the roof. I slowly put my arms under his waist. "The quality of mercy is not strained," I quoted. "It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven." Frank laughed and looked upwards.
The overlapping stains on the ceiling boded ill for the prospects of our sleeping dry all night. If that's a sample of your mercy, he said, I'd hate to see your vengeance. The thunder went off like a mortar attack, as though in answer to his words, and we both laughed at ease again. It was only later, listening to his regular deep breathing beside me, that I began to wonder. As I had said, there was no evidence whatsoever to imply unfaithfulness on my part. My part. But 6 years, as he'd said, was a long time. Chapter 2. Standing Stones. Mr. Crook called for me, as arranged, promptly at 7 the next morning. So as we'll catch the dew on the buttercups, alas, he said, twinkling with elderly gallantry. He had brought a motorcycle of his own approximate vintage, on which to transport us into the countryside. The plant presses were tidally strapped to the sides of this enormous machine, like fenders on a tugboat. It was a leisurely ramble through the quiet countryside, made all the more quiet by contrast with the thunderous roar of Mr. Crook's cycle, suddenly throttled into silence. The old man did indeed know a lot about the local plants, I discovered. Not only where they were to be found, and their medicinal uses, and how to prepare them. I wished I had brought a notebook to get it all down, but I listened intently to the crackled old voice and did my best to commit the information to memory as I stowed our specimens in the heavy plant presses. We stopped for a packed luncheon near the base of a curious flat-topped hill. Green as most of its neighbours, with the same rocky juts and crags, it had something different, a well-worn path leading up one side and disappearing abruptly behind an outcrop. "What's up there?" I asked, gesturing with a cheese and pickle sandwich. "It seems a difficult place for picnicking." "Ah," Mr. Crook glanced up the hill. "That's Crenadon, lass. I'd meant to show ye after our meal." "Really? Is there something special about it?" "Oh, aye," he answered, but refused to elaborate further, merely saying that I'd see when I saw. I had some fears about his ability to climb such a steep path, but these evaporated as I found myself panting in his wake. At last, Mr. Crook extended a gnarled hand and pulled me up over the rim of the hill. "There it is," he waved a hand with a sort of proprietorial gesture. "Why, it's a henge," I said, delighted. "A miniature henge." Because of the war, it had been several years since I had last visited Salisbury Plain, but Frank and I had seen Stonehenge soon after we were married. Like the other tourists wandering awed among the huge standing stones, we had gaped at the altar stone where ancient druid priests performed their dreadful human sacrifices, announced our sonorous Cockney guide. Out of the same passion for exactness that made Frank adjust his ties on the hanger so that the ends hung precisely so, we had even trekked around the circumference of the circle, pacing off the distance between the Z holes and the Y holes and counting the lintels over the Sarsen circle, the outermost ring of monstrous uprights. 3 hours later, we knew how many Y and Z holes there were, 59, if you care, I didn't, but had no more clue to the purpose of the structure than had the dozens of amateur and professional archaeologists who had crawled over the site for the last 500 years. No lack of opinions, of course. Life among academics had taught me that a well-expressed opinion is usually better than a badly expressed fact, so far as professional advancement goes. A temple, a burial ground, an astronomical observatory, a place of execution, hence the aptly named Slaughterstone that lies to one side,
half sunk in its own pit. An open-air market. I like this last suggestion, visualising megalithic housewives strolling between the lintels, baskets on their arms, critically judging the glaze on the latest shipment of red clay beakers and listening septically to the claims of Stone Age bakers and vendors of deer bone shovels and amber beads. The only thing I could see against the hypothesis was the presence of bodies under the altar stone and cremated remains in the Z-holes. Unless these were the hapless remains of merchants accused of short-waiting the customers, it seemed a bit insanitary to be burying people in the marketplace. There were no signs of burial in the miniature henge atop this hill. By miniature, I mean only that the circle of standing stones was smaller than Stonehenge. Each stone was still twice my own height and massive in proportion. I had heard from another guide at Stonehenge that these stone circles occur all over Britain and Europe, some in better repair than others, some differing slightly in orientation or form, all of purpose and origin unknown. Mr. Crook stood smiling benignly as I prowled among the stones, pausing now and then to touch one gently, as though my touch could make an impression on the monumental boulders. Some of the standing stones were brindled, stripped with dim colours. Others were speckled with flecks of mica that caught the sun with a cheerful shimmer. All of them were remarkably different from the clumps of native stone that thrust out of the bracken all around. Whoever built the stone circles, and for whatever purpose, thought it important enough to have quarried, shaped, and transported special stone blocks for the erection of their testimonial. Shaped how? Transported how? And from what unimaginable distance? My husband would be fascinated, I told Mr. Crook, stopping to thank him for showing me the place and the plants. I'll bring him up to see it later. The gnarled old man gallantly offered me an arm at the top of the trail. I took it, deciding, after one look down the precipice decline, that in spite of his age, he was probably steadier on his pins than I was. I swung down the road that afternoon towards the town to fetch Frank from the manse. I happily breathed in that heady Highland mix of peat and evergreen, spiced here and there with wood smoke and the tang of fried herring. Those houses near the road were nice. Some were newly painted, and even the manse, which must be at least 100 years, sported fresh maroon trim around its sagging window frames. The minister's housekeeper answered the door, a tall, stringy woman with 3 strands of artificial pearls around her neck. Hearing who I was, she welcomed me in and towed me down a long, narrow, dark hallway, lined with sepia engravings of people who may have been famous personages of their time or cherished relatives of the present minister, but might as well have been the royal family for all I could see of their features in the gloom. By contrast, the minister's study was blinding with light from the enormous windows that ran nearly from the ceiling to floor in one wall. An easel near the fireplace, bearing a half-finished oil of black cliffs against the evening sky, showed the reason for the windows, which must have been added long after the house was built. Frank and a short tubby man with a dog collar were cosily poring over a mass of tattered paper on the desk by the far wall. Frank barely looked up in greeting, but the minister politely left off his explanations and hurried over to clasp my hand, his round face beaming with sociable delight. "Mrs. Randall," he said, pumping my hand heartily, How nice to see you again. And you've come just in time to hear the news. News? Casting an eye on the grubbiness and typeface of the papers on the desk, I calculated the date of the news in question as being around 1750. Not precisely stop the presses, then. Yes, indeed, we've been tracing your husband's ancestor, Jack Randall, through the army dispatches of the period. The minister leaned close, speaking out of the side of his mouth like a gangster in an American film. I've borrowed the original dispatches from the local historical society files. You'll be careful not to tell anyone? Amused, I agreed that I would not reveal his deadly secret, and looked about for a comfortable chair in which to receive the latest revelations from the 18th century. The wing chair nearest the windows looked suitable, but as I reached to turn it towards the desk, I discovered that it was already occupied. The inhabitant, a small boy with a shock of glossy black hair, was curled up in the depths of the chair, sound asleep. Roger, the minister coming to assist me, was as surprised as I. The boy, startled out of sleep, shot bolt upright, wide eyes the colour of moss. Now what are you up to in here, you young scamp? The minister scolded affectionately. Oh, fell asleep reading the comic papers again. He scooped up the pages and handed them to the lad. Run along now, Roger. I have business with the Randalls. Oh, wait, I've forgotten to introduce you. Mrs. Randall, this is my son, Roger. I was a bit surprised. If ever I'd seen a confirmed bachelor, I would have thought the Reverend Mr. Wakefield was it. Still, I took the politely proffered paw and shook it warmly, resisting the urge to wipe a certain residual stickiness on my skirt. The Reverend Mr. Wakefield looked fondly after the boy as he went off towards the kitchen. My niece's son, really, he confided. Father shot down over the channel, and mother killed in the Blitz. So I've taken him. How kind of you, I murmured, thinking of Uncle Lamb. He too had died in the Blitz on his way to the British Museum where he had been lecturing. Knowing him, I thought his main feeling would have been gratification that the bomb had not hit the museum. Not at all, not at all. The minister flapped a hand in embarrassment. Nice to have a bit of a young life about the house. Now, do have a seat. Frank began talking even before I had set my handbag down. The most amazing luck, Claire, he enthused, thumbing through the dog-eared pile. The minister's located a whole series of military dispatches that mention Jonathan Randall. Well, a good deal of the prominence seems to have been Captain Randall's own doing, the minister observed, taking some of the papers from Frank. He was in command of the garrison at Fort William for 4 years or so, but he seems to have spent quite a bit of his time harassing the Scottish countryside on behalf of the Crown. This lot, he gingerly separated a stack of papers and laid them on the desk, is reports of complaints lodged against the captain by various families and estate holders, claiming everything from interference with their maidservants by the soldiers of the garrison to outright theft of horses, not to mention assorted instances of insult unspecified. I was amused. So you have the proverbial horse thief in your family tree, I said to Frank. He shrugged, unperturbed. He was what he was, and there's nothing I can do about it. I only want to find out. The complaints aren't all that odd for that particular period. The English in general, and the army in particular, were rather notably unpopular throughout the Highlands. No, what's odd is that nothing ever seems to have come of the complaints, even the serious ones. The minister, unable to keep still for long, broke in. That's right. Not that officers then were held to anything like modern standards. They could do very much as they liked in minor matters. But this is odd. It's not that the complaints were investigated and dismissed. They're just never mentioned again. You know what I suspect, Randall? Your ancestor must have had a patron. Someone who could protect him from the censure of his superiors. Frank scratched his head, squinting at the dispatches. You could be right. Had to have been someone quite powerful, though. High up in the army hierarchy, perhaps. Or another member of the nobility outside the army. Yes, or possibly, the minister was interrupted in his theories by the entrance of Mrs. Graham, the housekeeper. I've brought you a wee bit of refreshments, gentlemen, she announced, setting the tea tray firmly in the centre of the desk, from which the minister rescued his precious dispatches in the nick of time. She looked me over with a shrewd eye, assessing the twitching limbs and faint glaze over the eyeballs. I've brought but the two cups, for I thought perhaps Mrs. Randall would care to join me in the kitchen. I've a bit of... I didn't wait for the conclusion of her invitation, but leapt to my feet with alacrity. I could hear the theories breaking out again behind me as we pushed through the swinging door that led to the manse's kitchen. The tea was hot and fragrant, with bits of leaf swirling through the liquid. Mmm, I said, setting the cup down. It's been a long time since I tasted Earl Grey. And we'll leave the reading there till next week. That is the end of this episode, folks. I hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget, if you've got any questions or topics you'd like to discuss, you can send in a voice message to me through the Anchor platform or on Instagram, and I'll include it in an upcoming podcast. Hope you have a good week. We'll talk again soon. Be safe, stay kinky, as if you had any choice in the matter. This is TFD. Good night.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.